You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire. Mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ramare Friday. I'm your host, Jessica Hopkins, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'll be filling in for Liam and David today. This week on the show, I spoke to Executive Director of the New Zealand Initiative, Dr. Oliver Hartwich, and Associate Professor of Media and Communications at the University of Auckland, Dr. Neil Curtis, about UK Prime Minister Liz Truss's resignation. Then, Victoria University student and disability advocate Alice Mander talked to me about the Electoral Review Panel and who they want to hear from to shape the potential future of New Zealand's electoral system. And today on The Wire is our Bird of the Year special. I spoke to Forrest and Bird, as well as several campaign managers, about the competition, and this might hopefully help you decide which bird you are going to give your vote to. Hei aho o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts, or I would love to hear your thoughts, on any of these pieces today, so tuku pātuhi mai. You can text me on 5395 Waiamai Rane, or give me a call in the studio on 309 3879. And remember, you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. Let's get into it.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Liz Truss has resigned as UK Prime Minister after just 6 weeks following her failed economic policy. The Conservative Party, which holds a big majority in Parliament, will now elect a new leader by October 28. First, I spoke to Executive Director of the New Zealand Initiative, a public policy think tank in Ponaki, Oliver Hartwich, about Truss's 45 tumultuous days as Prime Minister. Here is that interview. Can you give us a bit of an overview of Liz Truss's time as Prime Minister and what ultimately led to her resignation?
Well, Liz Truss had a brief but tumultuous time as British Prime Minister. It only lasted about 45 days, but it was one of the most extraordinary episodes in recent British politics. And that says something because there have been many political troubles, of course, for Britain since the Brexit vote. She became Prime Minister, rather, just a few days before the monarch passed away, and that dominated her first couple of weeks in the job. And after that, her Chancellor of the Exchequer, so basically her Finance Minister, presented a so-called mini-budget. And that was basically a collection of tax cuts, but they were unfunded, and they were increasing Britain's fiscal hole to about 8% of GDP. And that's when markets rebelled, when the International Monetary Fund told Britain that they can't do that. That's when pound sterling collapsed in markets. That's when the Bank of England had to intervene, and Britain was facing an almighty financial and economic catastrophe. So she had to basically revise all of these policies. She fired her chancellor for basically implementing her own policies, and then just a few days later also lost her Home Secretary over a disagreement on immigration policy. And then she tried to bully her own party into a vote in the House of Commons, and that was really when things got too much, even for her most ardent supporters, and she had to resign. So it was an extraordinary time for the Conservative Party, and now the party is really looking at the shambles of their now 12 years in government. And if an election were held tomorrow, they could be reduced to, I've seen one opinion poll saying it could just be a single Conservative MP with a Labour majority of more than 500 MPs.
Truss resisted resigning up until even yesterday after her failed economic policy. So what yes. might have gone on behind the scenes between so soon ago when she was defending herself and now to ultimately drive her out?
Well, I think it became apparent that there was absolutely no support for her left, especially after that disastrous vote in the House of Commons. So initially she wanted to make this a vote of confidence in her own policies and in her person. And that's when Tory MPs rebelled they didn't want to support it that way. Then they were bullied by the chief whip. The chief whip then was seen actually walking out of the scene in the comments saying, oh, I'll quit and I'm not having to do anything with that anymore, and then unresigned just a couple of hours later. So the scenes in the House of Commons were absolutely shambolic, and I saw one interview with a senior Tory backbench MP saying that in his 17 years in the House of Commons, he'd never seen anything like it, and he was ashamed to be part of that parliamentary faction. So back last night, I think it was absolutely clear that they couldn't go on that way. I saw one quote from an unnamed Tory backbench MP who was also a medical doctor saying if that happened to a patient of his, he would probably advise the relatives it's a matter of hours, not days. And when I read that comment, I thought, okay, the writing's on the wall, and she will be forced to resign. And that's what she did then just a few hours later. The really interesting question is how the party will go on, because obviously they couldn't have a dragged-out election for the next leader as they had over the British summer this year. So they're trying to compress this now into just a week. So by Monday, the candidates for the leadership have to present 100 signatures of their parliamentary colleagues. There will be a vote in the parliamentary faction. The final two candidates would be put to a ballot of the membership unless the runner-up withdraws from the contest, in which case we would see some kind of coronation with a new prime minister installed by Friday next week.
What is the UK's history of short prime minister terms in the UK? Is Truss the shortest ever, and does anyone even come close?
Yes, I had to look that up, actually. I wasn't quite sure how bad it is, but no, she is definitely the shortest-serving prime minister by quite a mile. You have to go back into the early 19th century to find a prime minister who was at a job for, I think it was just about 3 months at the time. But typically they last a little bit longer. I mean, the longest serving British prime minister was Walpole, also 19th century, for 20 years. The most recent prime minister, of course, only served just a few years. I mean, Theresa May, Boris Johnson didn't last long. David Cameron had 6 years. Before him, Gordon Brown, I think, had, from memory, about four or so, maybe three or four. And then Tony Blair, of course, from 1997 to, I think it was 2006, when he passed on to Gordon Brown. So it's a recent phenomenon that these prime ministerships are getting shorter again. But in absolute terms, she's not the shortest by quite. She is the shortest, because you have to really go back into the early 19th century to find something comparable.
Now that Truss has resigned, could you speak to who we might see run for the position? Could Boris potentially be back?
Well, under normal circumstances, you would say, of course not, because he still has an investigation hanging over his head from the party affair that led to his resignation. He might even lose his parliamentary seat and be forced into a by-election, which he probably wouldn't win. So under normal circumstances, you would say Boris Johnson has no chance of regaining his old job. But then again, these are not normal circumstances in Britain, and everything is possible. So he is in the run. He might have the support of enough of his parliamentary colleagues to be one of the candidates on Monday. The other candidate, of course, is Rishi Sunak, the former chancellor. So he kept himself really quiet. He was a contestant, of course, in the contest to replace Boris Johnson over the summer, and he didn't get it back then. And we haven't actually heard much from Rishi Sunak since. He had warned publicly, of course, before or during the leadership contest that Liz Truss's economic policies would fail, and he was proven right. So he would probably secure the nomination of at least 100 of his colleagues again. And then there are a few odd ones out. There might be Penny Mordaunt, who some commentators think might have another crack at it. Then there is Jeremy Hunt, who was just named Chancellor of the Exchequer, and maybe even Grant Chaps. But I think then it becomes really speculative. I think none of them is likely to get 100 signatures. But then again, the British political scene is so unpredictable these days, almost anything is possible, regardless of who they pick now as leader. The next election is almost certainly going Labour's way, and Britain will get a change of government after, 14 years of Conservative government.
Next, I spoke to Associate Professor of Media and Communication at the University of Auckland, Dr. Neil Curtis, about how UK politics has got to its current state and what it could mean for Aotearoa this upcoming general election. We've had Liz Truss just resign. She's the shortest serving Prime Minister ever in the UK. Neil, everyone's wondering,
what on earth is going on in the House of Commons?
what is going on in the House of Commons? How did we get here?
That is a very, very difficult question to answer. But I think generally we have a Conservative Party in the UK that has been dominated, completely dominated for a long time now by entirely ideological and extremely dogmatic thinkers, supported by sort of hard right neoliberal think tanks. And on top of that, you've had MPs who are kind of prepared to do anything to get ministerial appointments. So I think it's that kind of pretty toxic mix of dogma and egotism without any attention to facts, reality, interests of a country, concern for society. I think in general terms, that is the way I would understand it. And I think we've seen that transition of the Conservative Party. I mean, it's been a very, very long transition, right? Starting with Thatcher, sort of her antisocial revolution begun in 1979. But she still had an international and sort of global perspective, although she did play the nationalist card. She sort of eulogized Victorian Britain. She was a defender of empire. She used the Union Jack whenever she could, but she was also a pragmatic politician who understood the importance of international relations and in particular the EU. But that dogma of neoliberalism, the antisocial dogma, was started by her. And then you had the sort of nationalistic turn, which I believe was a response to the failures of neoliberalism. We had increased inequality, an unstable economy that manifested in the financial crisis, greater sort of gaps in wealth, increase in poverty, undermining of public services, introductions of austerity. And I think to maintain the neoliberal program and dogma in relation to that, they then needed to find an enemy. They needed to distract people with an enemy. So, since Thatcher, really, the enemy had always been the sort of the workshy, the lazy welfare people and so on. Then it became sort of foreigners, immigrants in particular, and refugees. Then it became the EU. And I think the turn to nationalism was in part to sort of put a kind of a band-aid over all the problems and still enable them to pursue this kind of free market dogma and the complete myth of trickle-down economics. And then you have the additional thing with Brexit being a way to get rid of labour protections in the UK in order to further entrench neoliberal dogma. So, I mean, it's a very complex and long historical process, but once you end up with the pure dogmatists and the pure egotists running a major party who happen to be in government for 12 years, that is a complete recipe for disaster. So that would be a very short version of the sort of the long process that's happened.
How did Truss's approach and her sort of messaging compare to that of Boris, although she was only in the role for such a short amount of time?
I think Johnson is a sort of an arch neoliberal in many respects, like Truss, and a nationalist like Truss. But I think Johnson was happy to play a broader populist card by attempting to deploy some sense of social engagement and to some degree of welfare. But I think that was Rishi Sunak as the Chancellor, right, who was prepared to spend money to try to sort of prop up things, support things. I mean, Johnson doesn't care what happens as long as he's in power, right? He's not bothered. So Sunak took a slightly different approach, which came out in Johnson's premiership. But of course, that approach was rejected by the sort of dogmatists in the Conservative Party, who went for Truss, who was promising these ridiculous tax cuts, even though everybody knows that trickle-down economics is as mythical as a unicorn and as crazy as any conspiracy theory you might wish to imagine, right? So they voted for her. So I think the difference was that Johnson would go for anything as long as it kept him in power, and he had a chancellor that had some actual basis in economics, so he understood that there still was some important role for the state in terms of shoring up against the sort of chaos of sort of casino capitalism that we sort of live in now. And as I say, Boris Johnson wouldn't be bothered about any of that as long as it kept him in power. Why Johnson was thrown out was because he's so corrupt and so fundamentally immoral, and that was kind of bad for polling, so they got rid of him. But of course now there's talk of trying to bring him back. We've entered a kind of age of sort of zombie conservatism, I think.
I want to ask you about what this could mean for Aotearoa. Chris Luxon, National Party leader, has said that his party strongly aligns with Liz Truss's government. So what could this possibly mean for the next general election?
He also said that he aligns himself and his party with the Brexit project.
Right.
And as I said before, Brexit was primarily, the nationalism and the sort of freedom stuff was really a sort of smoke and mirrors. The main reason for Brexit was to be able to get rid of the work time directive, right, where people are only legally supposed to work a certain amount of hours. And it would afford them the ability to tear up as much labour regulation as possible. And of course, this is where Luxon comes from. This is who Luxon is, right? He's a businessman who's hell-bent on just getting as much market share as he can, which means getting as much wealth for the class that he represents, and ensuring that market share comes at the expense of workers. So, yes, he is profoundly ideologically aligned with that wing. I mean, if you remember, he went over and spoke to one of these hard right think tanks in the UK. That was that sort of infamous speech he gave, where he sort of slagged off every single aspect of New Zealand society and economics, right? Because it wasn't sufficiently hard right and neoliberal for him. Yes, that's where the National Party would currently take us if they were to get in. So it is troubling, and I'm not sure people are paying enough attention to that. And this is a very serious time we're living in politically and economically, and there are a group of very, very powerful people who are doing everything they possibly can to further increase their power and further increase their wealth, and in the process completely undermine democracy. And unless we pay attention to it, we're in deep trouble.
That was Dr. Oliver Hartwich and Dr. Neil Curtis on Liz Truss's resignation. I'll be back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
95 BFM presents Aldous Harding live at the Auckland Town Hall, October 26th.
All my favourite places are bars.
Her first Aotearoa performances since 2020, Aldous Harding returns with the mystifying and delicately rendered sound of her new album, Warm Chris. Aldous Harding, Wednesday, October 26th at the Auckland Town Hall. Get your tickets now from livenation.co.nz.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
Hawkins Live, followed by DJs Bobby Brazuka and Grantis.
And tomorrow,
DJs Chip Matthews and TDK.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Ahead of their sold-out December show at the Tuning Fork, Dry Cleaning are back with a brand new album,
Gary Ashby.
Stump Work.
Have you seen Gary?
Following up their critically lauded debut, Dry Cleaning are back with producer John Parrish for a sophomore album that's ambitious, intelligent, and surreal.
You could take control of my mind or body anytime. Why do I trust you?
Stump Work. The new album from Dry Cleaning. Available now wherever fine music is sold.
I'm not shocked. It happens all the time.
The Others Way Festival is just around the corner with over 30 acts of big-time musical goodness.
Featuring Anthony Tonin, The Coolies, Shafu and the Crates, Dance Exponents, Earth Tongue, Laura Jean, Mind Design and the Rare Pleasures, Pneumatics, Nadia Reid, Steve Gunn, Swidit, Te Kahu,
and so much more.
95BFM presents The Others Way this Saturday all along Cade Road. Don't miss out. Get your tickets now from Under the Radar and flyingout.co.nz. Hi, Mum. Yeah, happy birthday for the other week. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm just calling to let you know I'm going to be performing live on BFM. Yeah, with my band. No, my new band. Yeah, I have got a real job. That doesn't mean I can't still... Journalist is a real job. No, Mum, BFM. It's not just for students. It's like cool, alternative. Yeah, well, I hate you too. See you never, Mum.
Every Friday, live music direct from 95BFM Drive. Friday Live on 95BFM. Thanks to Parrot Dog Bear.
Classic journo question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Forests and Birds annual Bird of the Year competition, Te Manu Rongonui o Te Tau, is underway with 71 candidates vying to be this year's top bird. I spoke to Alan Rikers from Forest and Bird about why Bird of the Year is so important for raising awareness about Aotearoa's diverse bird species, 80% of which are currently under threat of extinction. Could you start off by telling our listeners about what Bird of the Year is?
Sure. So Bird of the Year started off way back in 2005 as a fun little competition for members to vote in through our flagship magazine, the Forest and Bird magazine. And I guess with the sort of growth of social media and the competition moving online, it's sort of become this massive phenomenon. And it's really designed to raise awareness for all of New Zealand's amazing native bird species, 80% of which are threatened or at risk of extinction. So it's basically a chance to celebrate the awesome birds we have here and also have a conversation about, you know, how they're doing and what we can do to help them.
This year, Forest and Bird has identified 20 underbirds. Can you tell us about what these are and why Forest and Bird is encouraging people to support them this year?
Sure. Typically, in not only in Bird of the Year, but in sort of conservation in general, we tend to focus on the kei birds, the kaka, the kia, the kakapo, the kiwi, those sort of well-known charismatic species. But New Zealand has more than 200 native bird species, and there are 71 on our candidate list. And so we'd just really love voters to maybe meet a new bird that they hadn't heard of before, because so many of them have, you know, great backstories, interesting lifestyles, or they're just really cute. The underbirds is really a chance for New Zealanders to meet some of those birds that aren't doing so well in Bird of the Year and also are underbirds in life because many of them are in serious trouble.
You mentioned that Bird of the Year ultimately is for a great cause. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
80% of New Zealand's birds are threatened or at risk of extinction, and Forest and Bird is the voice for nature. So we have projects that are on the ground doing predator control to protect birds like the popokotea, the whitehead at Bushy Park Sanctuary in Whanganui. And then we're also an advocacy group, and so we're trying to, you know, secure climate action and better ocean management so that all of our wildlife, not just birds, but all of our wildlife can really thrive. Bird of the Year is, I guess, a chance to say, hey, we have these really awesome, cool bird species here. Some of them are really not doing so well, so what can we do to help? So it's really an awareness-raising thing. There's no prize for the top bird except for bragging rights and glory.
So it's shaping up to be a heated competition. So how can people vote and when is their deadline?
Head to the Bird of the Year website, birdoftheyear.org.nz, and you can pick up to 5 birds as part of your vote. And then make sure you validate your vote. So we'll send a little code to your email so that we can make sure that you're not a robot or someone trying to cheat the system, as we've had in the past. The voting closes on Sunday the 30th of October at 5 p.m. and we'll announce the winner on the morning of Monday the 31st of October.
And to help you make your decision, I spoke to several of this year's campaign managers about why their bird should get your vote and why Bird of the Year is important to them.
My name is Ariel Haswell and I am a PhD student of the University of Auckland, and I study seabirds and how they perceive plastic pollution and light pollution. And as in a collaboration with BirdCare Aotearoa, we are campaigning for Cook's Petrels to be Bird of the Year in New Zealand. The Titi and Orcooks petrels is, they are very small and little unique bird, mainly because between April to May, many young fledgling Titi are grounded by light pollution. Over the years, we've seen a rise in numbers of seabirds and Titi coming into bird care as a result of landing on the ground from light pollution, being disorientated by them, colliding with infrastructure, colliding even with people's windows, and being found on the curbside. And so these birds deserve recognition and awareness and should have your vote.
My name's Sol. I've been an avid voter of Bird of the Year for a few years now. I also studied conservation at university. I just graduated last year. And I think it's an incredibly important thing for New Zealand to be heavily involved in conservation. And the best way to do that is to get people that don't know much about birds voting for them and, you know, loving them. So Bird of the Year is a really good way of doing that.
Don Jordan, sort of got involved with Bird of the Year for the first time this year after actually seeing online that, you know, anyone can volunteer to be a campaign manager for Forest and Bird. I love birds. I'm originally from the States, and when I moved to New Zealand, like, just really got into a bit of bird watching and, you know, all of the amazing manu that New Zealand has. So I thought it would be just such a fun way to kind of, I've really enjoyed the banter in previous years that I've seen, so I thought it would be a fun way to get involved and support perhaps a bird that is lesser known, one of the underbirds this year. I'm a big fan of the kaki. I think it is one of the underbirds that Forest and Bird are promoting this year. And I think really it is, you know, an incredibly endangered bird. There's less than 170 of them remaining in the wild. And almost no chicks survive to adulthood in the wild. So it's a bird that really needs our support. There's programs like the Kaki Recovery Program and the Isaac Conservation and Wildlife Trust that do some amazing work. But despite it being such an endangered and such an incredible kind of native bird, very few people have heard about it. So I think I'm really sort of just on a mission to kind of get that awareness. It needs as much support as some of our other birds, like the takahe or the kakapo, that are like quite famous. I think it's a great bird. They're really quite interesting creatures. They live like in the Mackenzie Basin, so they don't migrate at all to the coast, even when it drops below zero. They just kind of stick it out in the cold, even sometimes spotted standing around in the mornings with their ice on their wings waiting for the sun to melt it. They're tough. They're graceful, elegant, and I think they're a bird that really needs our support.
Kia ora, I'm Melissa Boardman. I live in Wellington, and I am campaigning for Te Te Ponamu Riflemen for Bird of the Year. They are our smallest bird, and I volunteer with them at Delandia Eco Sanctuary and know all about how great they are. So, yeah, I'm campaigning for them this year again. I think Te Te Ponamu are the perfect bird. They are an ancient endemic species. They're found nowhere else. They're absolutely tiny, and they are round, stumpy little birds. They have these stumpy little wings and an even stumpier tail. And they look like little marshmallows, and they are just super energetic and never stop moving. Oh, I love Bird of the Year time. It gets the whole country buzzing about our native wildlife, and it's such a fun way to get people involved in nature-themed events and activities that they wouldn't usually be. So it kind of, for me, it just gets the whole country talking about nature and our wildlife, and it's such a great platform.
My name is Sharon Simpson, and I am the campaign manager for the South Island Kōkako. The South Island Kōkako is a really unique bird to be voting for. So technically, it's extinct. Technically, it's data deficient, which means that it might be extinct. What our campaign is trying to do is to raise awareness of the bird and to make sure that if people are out there and they're in the South Island and they see it, they know to report it. The reason I say it might be extinct is because we haven't had any official sightings since 1968, but it was last seen in 2007. Since then, we've had a charitable trust established to track sightings of the bird. We've had quite a few really good sightings, good reportings of the bird, and we've also had recordings of sound of it. So essentially what we're trying to do is to find this bird before it's too late and bring it back. Birds are actually really important to us culturally. Like, if you think about it, we identify ourselves as birds, as Kiwis, of course, and we're just so used to having them around. But what we're not really aware of or not paying attention to is the dangers that they are facing. So they are facing predation, they're facing climate change. And they are really going down in numbers. I think that Bird of the Year is really connecting with people, really drawing on that cultural connection, but also really letting people see that the issues that they're facing and letting people get more involved with the birds. I'm based in the United Kingdom, and I've been over here for a few years, and I've really, really missed home. And what I've really missed is the birds, as ridiculous as that sounds. And we had the lockdown in 2020, where we were here for months and months, just locked down, and it was cold and it was horrible. And I managed to get COVID pretty early, so I was quite sick. So all in all, it was just a really not good time for me. But I was lying in bed one day and I was thinking, if I were back home, what would I be doing? And I was thinking, I would be working with the birds. And in an ideal world, I would be out with the birds. And then I realized that even though I'm far away, I can actually do something for them. So I picked up a campaign and started running.
Kia ora, my name is Francis, and I'm one of the campaign managers for the Karerea, or the New Zealand Falcon, for Bird of the Year this year. Why should people give their vote to the Karerea this year? I mean, it's a great question, but I think the question really here is why not? Which I think there's actually no answer to that question. The Karerea is an exceptional bird. It's capable of flying at speeds of over 100 kilometres per hour and can catch prey larger than itself. I guess one of the things about bird conservation is that we kind of tend to go for birds that are cute and small, because we think a vicious bird like the Karerea can defend itself. But unfortunately, the New Zealand Falcon is no match for a shotgun. New Zealand Falcons are still illegally shot by people, and they're also no match for electrocution on power poles, which is a really sad part of the small number of falcons that we have in New Zealand. They also collide with rotating turbine blades, which is really scary and awful. And yes, these birds may be vicious and quite incredible as our only endemic bird of prey, but they can't stand up against a rotating turbine blade on our wind farms, and that is why they need our help for conservation. So not only is the Karerea an incredible bird of prey, but it's also really misunderstood and really needs conservation help.
I live down here in Waitaha, Canterbury, and so I work for our regional council, kind of in the biodiversity scene. And when I kind of started, Doc were doing a bit of monitoring on the bittern by going out and listening to the booms. And as a little like nerdy 21-year-old, I was like, hells yes, let me in. So I went out and did the bittern booming. So you just kind of stand there and listen for an hour or so. And then I just kind of fell in love with this weird, socially awkward bird that no one knows anything about. And then this year I noticed that there was no kind of Instagram campaign. There's an amazing kind of Facebook campaign run by the Forest Bridge Trust, but I'm all about the memes. So I just started kind of campaigning for them. There's kind of the official answer, right, which is like so many of our birds are endangered in New Zealand, and much like them, there's only an estimated 1,000 Mātuku left. They're threatened, they're nationally critical, and we just don't know enough about them. So we need to kind of shoot a bit of spotlight on them, and so that we can start to create better monitoring systems and things like that and learn more about why and how we can restore their habitat. But I guess the unofficial answer is they're just a bit weird. Like, we love an underdog, and who doesn't love a kind of 2.5 foot tall, thick, weird-necked looking awkward bird? They're just a bit weird, and I kind of love that.
Tēnā koutou. My name's Dot Dalziel, and I work for Heringa Ānuku Aotearoa. We're the New Zealand Outdoor Access Commission. We're the Crown's tiniest agency, and we are very proud to be supporters of Piwowo, the rock wren, in this year's Bird of the Year competition. I'd say they're a bit like the black ferns. They're already at the top of their game, and they just need Rugby NZ to get in behind them. And so being the one true alpine bird native to Aotearoa, Piwowo, or the rock wren, need the recognition. Aldous Harding asks the question, what if birds aren't singing, they're screaming? I mean, by voting rock wren, you can help ensure that their voice is heard, whatever it is that they're on about. I think New Zealanders love to vote, and I think that Lord and others would, you know, really encourage more of us to vote more of the time. I think voting is really on people's minds, particularly at the moment. But, you know, to be fair, Bird of the Year has year on year pulled in more votes than many other kinds of voting that New Zealanders could get involved in. So I think it's the joy of it. I think it's the encouragement of all of the people who put hours and hours of work into rescuing, caring for, protecting the habitats of our native bird species. Not to mention the bats, of course, peka peka. So I think it really fires up people's imagination. Well, I'd just like to add that stoats and mice are literally eating piwowo out of house and home, and predator control is really important in the alpine areas they call home. Doc's got video footage of stoats with takeaways, as in live rock wren chicks. And in some areas, 100% of nests were emptied out, and they only hatch one brood a year, so it's truly devastating for this tiny threatened creature. So just a shout out for the beautiful underbird, the highest bird in our country. And maybe you'd like to go and check out our rap video at Team Rock Wren. That's our campaign's Facebook headquarter. This bird really is the big mozzarella.
Kia ora, I'm Daniel. I'm from Invercargill, and I'm campaigning the Southern New Zealand Dotterel, or Tūturi Whatu, for Bird of the Year this year. I've been working or volunteering with these birds since I was about 15 years old, and it's been really sad to see them decline in the last few years, and now they've sort of reached a low of only 144 birds left. And so, you know, time's running out to save them. And I suppose I'm just trying to raise awareness for the Southern New Zealand Dotterel, just because it doesn't get much media attention, and just trying to help get it as much support. I was sort of trying to speak to all the conservationists out there, all the people who love nature, you know, all the people who want to make a difference, you know. They have this opportunity by, you know, voting Southern Dotterel for Bird of the Year to help raise awareness for it and potentially save it from extinction. I feel like there's sort of an illusion out there in New Zealand that, you know, our critically endangered birds, you know, they get to that status of critically endangered, but everything's going to be okay sort of thing, you know, that and the population's stable or something like that, and that they get all the support they need. But that's really not the case here, because these birds are still in decline. The population definitely isn't stable. And so in the last few years, it's just been dropping year after year and probably going to drop again after this summer. And so just trying to raise awareness so that we can hopefully find some sort of corporate sponsor to help in the conservation effort, just a bit like your kākāpō has Meridian, or your Takahe has Mitre 10 or Fulton Hogan, something like that for these dotterels, because the DOC, the Department of Conservation team, working with the Dotterels, they do a fantastic job. And, you know, Doc is so busy working to save so many endangered species in New Zealand, birds, bats, skinks, plants. You know, they need all the support they can get. So I feel like raising awareness through this Bird of the Year competition is just a great way to get these birds more support. A little bit of a description about of what a southern dotterel is, for those who don't know. It's sort of about a medium-sized bird, probably similar size to a tui. They're found on the they breed on the mountaintops of Stewart Island, Rakiura. And I suppose in the summer they look like a bit of a tomato with feathers. They get bright red, sort of orangey feathers, and then in the winter time they have just sort of white, creamy white feathers. So they sort of change colour depending on when it's breeding season and when it's not. And yeah, they've just got a lot of character. They're really friendly birds. I was down south the other day, and the birds just came walking right up to me, probably within a metre, just to say hi. You know, they were real friendly birds, really inquisitive, and yeah, it would be devastating to see these guys become extinct.
Those were some of this year's Bird of the Year campaign managers. And after you finish listening to The Wire, go vote for your favourite birds in Bird of the Year. That's what I'll be doing. Let me know what birds you're going to be voting for, or what you think about any of our pieces today. Text me on 5395, and I'll be back after this short break.
Our boy Marlon Williams is back with a new album, My Boy, and a tour of Aotearoa next January. His first solo album since 2018's Make Way for Love, 2022 APRA Silver Scroll nominee Marlon Williams has delivered another gem of an album. Catch songs from My Boy, performed by Marlon and longtime band The Yarra Benders.
With the January 20th show selling out fast, a second show has just been added. Thursday, January 19th at The Civic.
Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Come face to face with cultural icons and discover extraordinary stories of art, love and life at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki.
Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, Art and Life in Modern Mexico, is the newest exhibition at the gallery.
Join as a member and get free, unlimited entry to this New Zealand exclusive show, so you can give the more than 150 artworks the time they deserve. Plus, get discounts, access to member-only events and more. Become a member today. Go to aucklandartgallery.com.
Motet's all set to blow with Ngā Meru Meru Bubbles.
3 days of hands-on fun and learning.
Catch a bubble, paint with bubbles, even get inside a giant bubble.
With little flick rides, food trucks, rainbow rascals and more, it's fun for the whole whānau.
Ngā Meru Meru Bubbles.
Labour Weekend, October 22nd, 23rd and 24th, 10 to 4pm at Motet.
Find out more at motet.nz.
Penny's Show.
Forget about Penny's Show, this is so much more important.
Join Penny Black for a very special Monday 1 to 4 show this Labor Day as Sean James Donnelly takes a break from his Mozart Fellowship to join her in studio, spin some of his favourite tunes and give you the lowdown on his chocolate box of a new album, Sweetheart.
Penny's Show.
SJD. This Monday, Labor Day on the 1 to 4 with Penny.
Which I do admit is popular with ordinary New Zealanders who have been forgotten.
Right here on 95 BFM.
We are.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And lastly, we're going to look at the Electoral Review Panel, which was appointed by the Minister of Justice in May to lead a review of Aotearoa's electoral law. The independent review will look at election rules such as the voting age and overseas voting funding of political parties. The panel is looking for people to share their thoughts on what could make our electoral system better before it makes its final recommendations to the government at the end of 2023. I spoke to Victoria University student and disability advocate Alice Mander about what the panel is expected to discuss and who they want to hear from.
We're reviewing our electoral system and everything that that means in this panel. So it's kind of like we describe it a health check for our electoral system. The way that we vote is already changing, and we kind of want to ensure that the electoral system reflects these changes, as well as safeguard what's working well and make improvements for current and future generations. So the panel, it has a lot of diverse experience, expertise and views, and it's made up of myself, Maria Barge, Lara Greaves, Robert Pedden, Andrew Geddes and Deborah Hart, and myself, and our job is to hear from New Zealanders and find out kind of what everyone wants for a future democracy and assess that basically, and then to provide recommendations to the government to make the electoral system clearer, fairer and more accessible.
What are some of the key things we can expect the panel to be looking at?
So the review covers basically everything to do with our elections, including, you know, who should have the right to vote. That includes voting disqualification, voting age, how to make the ways that we actually vote more accessible, what rules political parties have to follow, the MMP thresholds, parliamentary term. So basically everything. The things that are out of scope are online voting. We're taking for granted that Māori electoral seats will continue, so that's not part of our review. I'm also local government. So other than those things, we're basically looking at the entire system.
Why is it important for the panel to be hearing from young people in particular?
Young people have often been less engaged, or at least seem to be less engaged in the political system. It's so important that we hear from young New Zealanders about why that might be, you know, what barriers exist, how could it be easier for them, how could they be more engaged? And so, that's basically why it's so important for young people to get involved in this process, to ensure that, you know, as we move forward into the future, we have a system that reflects what young people and what the new generation really want.
As co-president and founder of the National Disabled Students Association, you would have a lot of insight into some of the barriers facing disabled people when it comes to things like voting. Could you speak a bit about what the panel might be looking at in this area in particular?
Yeah, so I think everything that the panel covers is relevant to disabled New Zealanders because, you know, it is such a broad population, and so we're really wanting to hear from disabled people about all issues. But as you say, particularly any access barriers that may limit participation either in voting or even in running in campaigning. And I think one way we're doing that is for some targeted engagement with disabled communities and disabled community groups, but we're also really hoping that individuals come forward as well, and we have accessible formats of our consultation document to facilitate that, which can be found on the website.
Can you walk us through the process of how people could make a submission and what that would involve?
Sure. So a couple of ways to make a submission. So on the electoralreview.govt.nz website, you can find the consultation document as well as a shorter summary and some translations of the document, including accessible formats. So that can be, you know, you can read that for an understanding of the issues. And then we're welcoming submissions on as much or as little as you really want to comment on. So you can either submit through the online form, which is on the website, sending an email through to the email address, which is on the website. And also, if you are wanting to actually talk to us, publicly engage with us, we have a few engagement sessions where we're inviting members of the public to come speak with us. So those are the main ways that members of the public can speak. And then, as I said, we're also doing some targeted engagement with certain groups. And there's two rounds of engagement, so we're really encouraging people to submit during this round, and then after this, which closes In November, we are going to be sort of revealing what we had and creating some interim suggestions and releasing an interim report. And then we'll be going out for consultation again to hear what the public has to say about our report. And then we'll be releasing the final report.
When can we expect potentially major changes to our electoral system to be introduced?
So our final report will come out in November 2023. So the government at that time will, I assume, have, you know, read through it and consider it, and then we'll see changes there. Some of our topics are also undergoing some changes at the moment, so there's a couple of bills going through the House. But we'll still be able to comment on those things, if the bills succeed or not.
That was The Wire.
Ko ereti hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Friday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us, Electoral Review Panel member Alice Mander, Executive Director of the New Zealand Initiative, Dr. Oliver Hartwich, Associate Professor of Media and Communications at the University of Auckland, Dr. Neil Curtis, Forest and Bird's Alan Rikers, and all of the Forest and Bird of the Year campaign managers. Ni rā hoki ti mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Liam and David will be back next week for more current affairs analysis. You're listening to 95BFM. Keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.